This is the Mormon Expression Podcast. Find us on the web at mormonexpression.com.
Jesse James was a farm boy. He got caught up in the war, the killing and...
Welcome back to part two of our discussion with Will Bagley on MormonExpression.com. And we will continue with the discussion already in progress.
So I came back to Utah. I started working construction and playing music. And I got a job at a wood shop with a guy named Bob Adams. And Bob was an old Southern Utahan and a dissident Mormon, former Mormon, and sort of a roustabout. But he'd collected a massive Mormon library, and he knew a lot about Mormon history. And he lent me the Confessions of John D. Lee in one of their very early editions, and a bunch of other early Mormon books. And my uncle was G. Ralph Bailey, who was a prominent Mormon book collector.
Was this when you started getting into Mountain Meadows Massacre?
By that time I'd read Winnie the Brooks.
Okay.
But Bob got me back into it. My uncle got me back into it.
Okay.
And I came out to Utah, and this was before the Hoffman, before Hoffman arrived. But I'd begun, and I was reading everything. And that's part of, I think, one big advantage I have as a historian, is I'd read everything. I'd read all this European history and military history, and I loved ancient history and Roman history and Greek history. And so I'd really been reading all the time since I left college. And it gave me a broader perspective than a lot of historians pick up. And I'd also begun to pick up fascination with Western history. And then it just kept sort of building on itself and accelerating. When the Hoffman affairs heated up, I became very interested in that stuff. Mm-hmm. And I once called Earl Olson, who was assistant church historian or something, and manager of LDS Archives, when there was a story that Hoffman had planted in the Salt Lake Tribune. And it was by a reporter that's still there, but it was a plant to create provenance for one of his forgeries. And he told the L.A. Times something, and the Times told the Salt Lake Tribune something, and then they call him, and he says, well, the church took me into the First Presidency's vaults, and I saw this history by Oliver Cowdery, and yada, yada, yada. And so by this time I was working at Evans & Sutherland Computer Company. And so I was sitting there and I go, I knew Earl Olson's name for some reason. He'd been in the newspaper. But so I called him up. And it was the first contact I had with the Mormon historical establishment. And I said, you read that article in the paper today? He goes, yes, it's all lies. And I said, well, do you guys have that Oliver Cowdery history? He goes, no, we never had, it doesn't exist. And so I go, well, do you have like an inventory of what's in that the church's vaults? No, and we'll never have one. And in fact, by that time, Max Evans, who was later head of the Historical Society, Jeff Johnson, who was later Utah State Archivist, they both compiled an inventory of what was in the First Presidency's vault, but they didn't bother to consult that when Hoffman was selling them the McClellan collection.
Interesting.
Because if they had, they might have gone, oh, Tauber, McClellan, what is that? And that's what Hoffman was looking for, was the Tauber collection of McClellan stuff. But anyway, so I gradually began becoming more enticed by it. And then I'd always wanted to be a writer, and I had gotten a job as a technical writer at Evans & Sutherland, which was a great job. And I went right from being working for a remodeling company as a Finnish carpenter to being a technical writer. And it was the last possible minute you could have gotten a job in a computer company based solely on some fairly sketchy writing skills. But every day I had to write. I had to interpret engineering specs or conversations and write functional descriptions. And then I began documenting software systems. And so the training I got in technical writing turned out to be absolutely first rate for historical writing. And we hired a technical writer named Peter Delafosse, who helped index some massive set of computer manuals we'd written. And Peter was a real book collector and was involved with the Marriott Library and began introducing me to people and got me into the Utah Westerners. And that's where I got my college, that's where I got my advanced degree.
Excellent.
Because I met this great body of old-time Utah, the old guard of Utah history. Brig Madsen, Ev Cooley, Arrington had been a member, but he wasn't when I was there, but I met Leonard later.
Leonard Arrington.
Who was one of the most lovable people I have ever met in my whole life.
Wow.
And who gave me access to his papers at LDS Archives when I was working on Abner Blackburn.
That's great.
But I began... I actually had wanted to write a book. And I wanted to write, initially I wanted to write a biography. I was going to write a book about No Man Knows My History and how Von Brody had written it, the controversies it involved. And I went up and I went through the Brody papers and I read these interviews with her. I saw her excommunication document,
really?
Her summary to her trial. And the interviews were just fascinating. And by this time, she died fairly recently, just a few years before. And I talked to her son, Bruce, in L.A. But everywhere I went, I tell people I was working on a biography of No Man Knows My History. And people would say, well, you know, Newell Bringhurst is working on a biography of Brody. And I knew that because I had found a bunch of Newell's articles. And then one day I was having a conversation with Ron Prittis when Signature Books had offices in Ochre Square,
mm-hmm.
Over on 4th South. And we were talking about Mormon history and what really needed to be done. And he said, well, you know, Ron's a Californian. And he said, nobody's ever written a biography of Sam Brannan. And I go, Sam Brannan, yes, yes, that's what I'll do. And I run into complicating factors with the Brody piece. And part of it was that Bringhurst, who'd done some pretty credible work, was working on it. But as I began doing research on Sam Brannan, what did people tell me? Newell Bringhurst is working on it. And at that point, I realized something that was a good lesson for all historians, which is don't care who's working on it. Nobody owns history. If you're interested in the subject and you think you can do something new and interesting on it, go ahead. And I don't care if Jesus Christ is working on the history of Jesus Christ. If you want to write a history of Jesus, write your own. And the bottom line is, a lot of people work on books forever and ever and ever and never produce them. And ultimately, Newell heard that I was working on a Brannan biography and probably somewhat with relief yielded the field to me.
Oh, well.
And I had an encounter with a British American citizen, Malcolm Barker. And I'd been working very intensively at the archives, and I collected this massive amount of stuff on Sam Brannan. And they told me, well, this really interesting guy came by named Malcolm Barker, and he said he was working on Sam Brannan, and he wanted to do a biography. And so I met him, I was very charmed, I invited him over to our house for dinner, and then I gave him everything I had on Sam Brannan and said, go ahead. And he said, I said, well, I'm going to keep doing this. And I was, at the time I was going to do what became Scoundrel's Tale, the Samuel Brannan papers. And I still someday hope I can write Scoundrel's Empire, the life of Samuel Brannan. Because Brannan is an epical Western character. And he's California's first millionaire. You know, he... After he drinks his way out of several fortunes and is living in pretty much poverty in Southern California, what does he predict is going to be the next great California gold rush? Citrus trees.
Citrus trees.
Lemon groves. Orange groves.
Of course.
Avocados. Sam was a visionary. Sam was raised in the home of Joseph Smith. He was an intimate of Joseph Smith. He learned everything he knew from the master. as I was researching Sam Brannan, who do I run onto in Dale Morgan but Abner Blackburn? And Dale Morgan was one of the first people to see the Blackburn narrative. And Dale Morgan is, of course, the greatest of all ever-living Utah historians. Do you know who he was?
I don't know.
He wrote Jedediah Smith and the Opening of the West, The Great Salt Lake. He is really the author of the Utah Guide that the WPA did.
Okay.
He wrote The West of William Ashley, which is right on the shelf up there, that big book.
Oh, yeah.
That is the definitive history of the American fur trade, as it exists, pretty much. Overland in 1846, two volumes of basically all the essential year of decision immigrant journals for the year the Donner Party blazed the trail through Utah, through the Wasatch Mountains. Mm. But all this great epic history, and so... the first formal thing I really did was Abner Blackburn's narrative. And Abner is the most charming, funny, self-deprecating... He's the Mormon Forrest Gump. He's everywhere. he is in Missouri. He's at Hans Mill. He is in Nauvoo. Works on the Nauvoo Temple, is in the Nauvoo Legion, gets tired of that, gets on the Missouri River, and goes on the General Brook to where Fort Union later stands, all the way up on one of the very first fur trading trips up the Missouri River, comes back, meets the Mormon immigrants in Iowa, Teamsters for Brigham Young across Iowa.
Wow.
And he tells the funniest story about Brigham Young. Abner's driving the oxen with one of Brigham's wagons, and Brigham is sitting up top of the hill, and he's watching everything go on. So, let's go to the hard part that you wanted to get to.
You have an axe to grind against the church, don't you? I mean, you're an anti-Mormon. you're an anti-Mormon in most faithful historian circles. So why don't you address that?
Well, you know what? It is true that I'm not a fan of corporate Mormonism. I'm not a fan of any kind of organized religion, in fact. But I don't really feel like I have an axe to grind. I know. You know, there's a quote that I've just taken out of it. I was going to put it in a book, and I decided I didn't have room. But it's a quote from Chaz Peterson, who was head of the Historical Society. Very, very good Utah Mormon historian. And it was written in 1991. It's about regionalism. And he says that the church's refusal to let historians see essential sources has been a point of contention, and it's divided the church from its historians. And that's right when I was beginning my work in Mormon history. And it was largely true. And I noticed in, I just got a new Journal of Mormon History. And I actually, it's an older one, but I hadn't seen it yet. Because I quit the Mormon History Association. But I got it, and there's a picture of Elder John Carmack. And the article is California Was Essential or something. And I'm sure Elder Carmack's a very nice guy, and he was supervisor, ecclesiastical supervisor of the church archives when I was working there. And he sat on a committee of three people, and two of the people were professional historians and archivists, and he was the authority, the 70 or whoever. Mm-hmm. This is when they didn't have a church historian. And I would have to go and find, basically out of the Journal History Index, a document that was referenced, quoted in the Journal History, with a little line, original on file. And if I could show them that, I had them. Because that said, we got it.
Right.
And generally, they'd bring it out and let me see it. Well, some things, First Presidency documents, this, you know, long, long list, were restricted. And every item I wanted to see in the Brigham Young papers or John Taylor papers or a whole range of different items. First of all, I had to find it somehow, find a reference to it, and then I had to write a letter, and then it had to go to the committee, and it had to pass Elder Carmack's inspection. And guess what? I quit going to LDS archives about 10 years ago. Pretty much quit. Stuff go back for some stuff.
Sure.
But I had filed a request, at the request of Bill McKinnon, to see a George A. Smith letter to Brigham Young, I think it was to Brigham Young, describing a meeting in 1856, summer of 1856, with Sam Houston of Texas. And I'd had a vague description of it, but Bill wanted a copy for what became at Swords Point. So I went and filled out the paperwork and filed the request, and the word came back that, once again, it was restricted. I couldn't see it. And it was another 2-3 vote where the one won. 2-1 vote where the one won. And so I couldn't see it. And then 2 weeks later, Artis Partial requested it for Bill again, and they gave it to her. Or Bill himself might have filed the request, and Bill's not LDS. And they gave it to him. And at that point, I said, this isn't a level playing field, and I'm not going to play their games anymore. And what was ironic was there was not anything in that George A. Smith letter that could have possibly been embarrassing or incriminating or that somebody with an axe to grind could have used. But I can show you the letter now at Swords Point, and it's published. It's in Kingdom in the West. And the church still stands. The church hasn't fallen
because of
that secret information. And the church, of course, when it was censoring documents, was faced by the key problem any censor has. What is it you censor? Oh, these words, or references to polygamy, or, you know. And so much of Mormon history is in code or language that's forgotten that oftentimes there are a number of historians out there who know a lot more than the church historians do. And they can see a set of words that if you know what that really means, then the letter becomes more important. And these documents are just fascinating because, I mean, this is where history comes from. This is the source. This is the real stuff.
Right.
And I confess I get mad when I have powerful Mormon officials and functionaries, like Ron Esplin, deny me access to critical materials, like the Brigham Young papers. Now, Leonard Arrington hired Edith Romney, who was a retired church secretary, and he hired her from funds in the Mormon History Foundation or Endowment or something. And he kept very carefully the receipts that paid for her to go through the core collections of LDS archives. And she transcribed 30,000 pages of Brigham Young letters, tens of thousands of pages of all kinds of critical journals, correspondences. These were all then in typescript. And I knew that there was a set at the Joseph Fielding Smith Institute, because when they were exiled from Camelot and wound up down in Provo, they took with them one of these bound sets. And so I go through this more rigmarole and wrote to, and I said, well, I'd like to look at, I'd like to go through those Romney things. And I've actually got an inventory that Mike Quinn did. I'll show it to you if you want. It's fascinating. It's astonishing what's in there. But this is the nut. This is everything valuable in LDS archives. It's what Arrington used to write American Moses. It's what he used to write Charles Rich. And actually, they were written by other people, but it's how the team did it.
Right.
And a lot of the team wound up at the Joseph Fielding Smith Institute. So... they explained to me that, well, if you want to see these things, you have to write a letter to LDS Archives, because they really own them, and tell them that you want permission to see them. And I said, well, Ron, you'd support that request, wouldn't you? And he goes, oh, yeah. So I write in, and they turn it down. And later, my friend Bill Hartley, who was the only productive member of the Joseph Fielding Smith Institute staff. Bill published lots of great stuff. And he invited me down in about 1998, I think. And I just published Thomas Bullock, Pioneer Camp of the Saints. And we'd announced the Kingdom in the West series, this multi-volume Arthur H. Clarke Documentary History of Mormonism. And people knew that I was working on the Mountain Meadows Massacre, because I didn't keep any of this secret. And so Bill said, well, why don't you come down and you can tell us all your plans, and we'll tell you what the church's publication plans are. And so, and I'd been hearing that they were going to do Brigham Young's Indian Letters and this, that, and the other. And so I was curious. And so, and I've been doing some research down at BYU Library on the Mountain Meadows. So I drive down, and I go in, and we start right after lunch, I think. And I go on for talking about what Arthur Clarke and what I'm going to do on the Mountain Meadows and what I found out. And that, yeah, I think Brigham Young is severely implicated in it, and I can show he was implicated in it. And I told him all the different volumes we were going to do in Kingdom in the West and the philosophy behind it and all this stuff. And then I began to realize, wait a minute, I'm answering all these questions and they're not telling me anything. So I stopped, and they had, it was funny, because they had all the staff, and Barney, or not, it was, what's wrong, Esplin. He's now head of the Joseph Smith Papers Project. Esplin was really belligerent. The rest of them were fairly friendly. Tom Alexander was a little standoffish. But the guy, the dark, menacing presence in the room was Jack Welch, the law professor, the farms founder, the eminence grise, and the big fish, it turns out. I don't think he had a position at the Institute, but they all had to come to him to get permission to breathe, to do anything. And he was very belligerent. And so finally, I said, well, I've shown you mine. You guys show me yours.
Right.
And everybody looks at Jack, and Jack goes, well, we have proposed some plans, but we have not yet had them authorized, so we can't tell you anything.
Great. You must have been pretty pissed.
Well, I wasn't all that pissed. I just laughed. I just thought that was hilarious. I think I said to him, you're kidding me. You mean, you guys have to get permission. You can't tell me what you're going to do? You can't even tell me what you've asked permission to do?
Or were they just intentionally withholding it from you?
Well, what difference could it make? Well, it was secret. But so anyway, poor Bill Hartley. And after the meeting's over, he comes up to me and very sheepishly said, well, Will, I guess you feel like you were sandbagged, huh? And I go, Bill, I was sandbagged.
Yep.
Oh, but in that meeting, I said, well, you know, I've asked for permission to see the Edith Romney type scripts. And everybody's going, oh! And I said, Ron, I said that you'd said that you would support that move. And he goes, you did what? But all these great experts had been talking about doing the Thomas Bullock Journal. You know, they all had plans to do that. And there had always been somebody who had plans to do it. And here's this lowly, uncredentialed, independent historian who writes into copyrights and permissions for the sesquicentennial of the Mormon Pioneer Trail. I'd like to do the official journal, the Brigham Young Pioneer Company, Thomas Bullock's Pioneer Camp of the Saints. And there it is. Won Best Documentary History from Mormon History Association.
Excellent.
And see, there were some awards up there. Same year I won Best Article. Might have been the first time anybody had won two awards in the same year.
Excellent.
But that was quite nice. And I was a new coming up historian. and then I became a professional historian in 1995, because as the world's luckiest historian, I answered an ad in the Salt Lake Tribune and Deseret News at the same time for a historian to document the 1859 Fancher Party.
Ooh.
And I wrote a letter and I said, well, first of all, it was 1857, it wasn't 1859. And it just so happens I've transcribed Dimmick Huntington's Indian 1857, 1858 journal, 59 journal, and it implicates Brigham Young in the massacre.
Wow. So you told him that right from the get-go, huh?
Well, it does. And they later told me that, and I said, well, you know, what I'll hire on to do, and I've told them about it, I had several published books, and then I said, what I'll commit to do is to give you, to do this, the research you want done, and to give you my best professional opinion, and write a narrative of what happened. But I did not commit to delivering anything.
Hmm.
And the one thing I committed to was to give them my best evaluation of it. And when I started, the first thing I did when I started out was to reread Juanita Brooks' Mountain Meadows Massacre, which is an absolutely astonishing piece of history.
I agree.
And very, very powerful. It shows you how powerful documentary history can be. And it is still one of the, I think, great pieces of moral, historical literature in Mormonism, because it is so courageous, and it is so honest, and it doesn't protect the guilty. At the end of the book, you know, everybody says, well, she says Brigham Young didn't order it. Yeah, she does. But what she says is, Brigham Young and George A. Smith set up the social conditions that made the massacre possible. Now, to me, I interpret that statement as assigning moral responsibility. And however you want to squirm about Brigham Young and this atrocity, he was morally implicated. He was responsible. The buck stopped there. And you can mince words or you can point fingers and pick favorites like Isaac Haight or William Dane or John D. Lee and make them out to be really, really bad guys who just weren't listening to the wonderful Christian counsel that was coming from Salt Lake. Well, that would be thoroughly tenable if anything but vitriolic, hate-filled, fear-mongering, violent orders, bloody rhetoric was coming from Salt Lake. And that's just what we know about. The thing that, one of the things that persuades me, and it's a tough historical argument, is all those documents that have disappeared, the minutes of the 12 apostles, those letters, the journals that have been torn out, and there are hundreds of them. We don't have more than a handful of what claimed to be. I think of two. We've got two diaries of southern Utah from that period. One is Jesse C. Smith, and the other is James Martineau. But they're both reminiscences. They're not journals. They're reconstructions much later on. And we don't have Martineau's contemporary journal. We have something of a record by Jacob Hamlin, but not a contemporary record. And what I find compelling is that missing evidence probably doesn't exonerate the high church authorities. And
well, isn't it that letter that they say that Brigham Young sent the day before the massacre is kind of the key piece of evidence?
The Haslam letter?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, that's the alibi.
Yeah.
Well, I've said quite a bit about the Haslam letter, and we really do quite the workover on it, and both Innocent Blood and the book that's coming out next year by Dave Bigler and Will Bagley called The Mormon Rebellion, America's First Civil War. And that's pretty much our last commentary on the subject. But there's a quote from Andrew Hamilton, who was defending Peter Zenger on a freedom of the press case in 1735. And Andrew Hamilton said, "The destruction of evidence ought always to be taken as the best evidence." Hmm. Now, innocent people don't destroy evidence. If Brigham Young weren't implicated in this up to his eyeballs, we'd know a lot more than we do. And the contemporary record that we have is very scary, frightening stuff. And if you think George A. Smith went down there to cheer people up and tell a few jokes, he went down there to set up an Indian incident. And that's, although many people have destroyed a straw man, they say is Blood of the Prophets. The thesis of Blood of the Prophets is pretty complex. But a big part of it is that Brigham Young, in August of 1857, made a political decision. He probably made it in July. And that decision was that he was almost powerless against the forces of the United States. But there was one thing he could do, and that was shut down the Overland Road. He could cut communications between the East Coast and the West Coast. And he could do this by manipulating the Indians, who was a federal Indian agent and governor of Utah. He was committed by oath to protect immigration, keep that road open. But no, that deals off with that. And now he's going to show them who's boss. But to make the point, he needs to show something. So what I believe he does is send George A. Smith down to set up an incident. Now, what were those orders? Well, as Sumner Howard the prosecutor who cuts the deal that gets Lee, as he said, whatever orders Brigham Young gave were long since destroyed by the time I got to prosecute the case. So I had to cut a deal with Brigham Young, and I cut a deal that at least got one guy in front of a firing squad. But the guy who had publicly in trial exonerated Brigham Young said, no, I knew that he destroyed any evidence and he controlled everything else, so we weren't going to convict him. But we could probably, if he agreed to the deal, we could get John D. Lee. And if you could only shoot one person for the crime at Mountain Meadows, John D. Lee was a pretty good candidate. But anyway, I'm not sure what exactly George A. Smith told him to do down there, but it wasn't to save your corn and the rest. He told Dame and Haight something, and it was something like, kill every American coming through southern Utah. We don't want anybody to carry tales out of here. Because the Haslam letter is entertaining, but the most revealing letter comes from D.H. Wells, the militia commander. And what does it say? It says, get the Indians off the road. Don't mess with the immigrants. Turn things around. Why do you have to send orders to militia commanders in southern Utah not to attack wagon trains? What possible purpose could those orders serve? It has to be a new order, which it is.
Well, then, in retrospect, what's your opinion against the Turley book, the new massacre book?
There's nothing new in it. I saw a good bit of the murderer stories that are told 35 years later. So they've got a whole new set of them. It's a very deceptive book. They pretend that they've got the chronology all nailed down. Well, there are problems with that, because every one of the dates that they give and sources on the dates, I can show you another date that's a day or two off, or a day or two later. Now, they have it all happening in a three-day weekend. Or the setup, the day between the arrival of the Fancher Party in Cedar City and the Monday morning attack. Now, if you've got ATVs and four-wheel drive vehicles, that you could probably pull that together. But what they do is they assemble not just a sizable militia force, of probably at least 50 Mormon men, but apparently some sort of Indian auxiliary. The church's book is very vague about how many Indians there are, but my take on it is, and I've wrestled with this question a lot, is there weren't that many, but there were at least enough to overmatch the party. And they were going to be the cannon fodder. These were the guys who were going to make that first rush. And they do. But the Paiutes aren't warriors. And they're telling them to do something that's completely contradictory to a very successful Paiute military strategy, which is, you shoot arrows in the cows, and when the immigrants get up, they're all pissed off, but they're not going to be able to find you, and the cows are going to die, and they're going to leave, and you get what? And you know what? Nobody gets hurt. Well, and the church does own up. Yeah, Lee put it all together. But if you read the setup on how, do a contrast between how I believe the massacre was staged and set up, and how they do. They use all these patently ridiculous quotes to talk about 200 or 300 bloodthirsty savage Indians. That was a fantasy to cover people's asses. The reality is they somehow picked up a ragtag bunch of Indians, freebooters is a term that was used at the time down there, probably got some Mojaves, probably got whoever was available, and maybe put a force together of 100 assault people that could do the assault. But the gunfire is coming from white guys hiding behind rocks. And they launch the attack. It's a disaster. Because how do they get the Paiutes to make it, to do something they've never done before and will never do again? How do you get them to make a frontal attack? You tell them, our magic will protect you. Nobody's going to get hurt. And Lee himself admits it. Some white guy told them they weren't going to get hurt, and they did, and they didn't buy it, and they all left. Well, yeah, that's probably, that's about as close to the truth as Lee gets. But it just is the chronology. How long is it going to take you to put that force of Indians together? A few hours? A couple of days?
Yeah.
We're going to be able to run out, and there's all these Paiute war bands gathered that are ready to go because they followed them all the way down from Corn Creek. It's all malarkey. They had to be working on launching that attack at least a week before. And that means that a militia commander, whose name would have been William Dame, had to give an order that says, go out there, Nephi Johnson, Dudley Levitt, and John D. Lee, and Carlos Schurz, and you get me some Indians up there to Mountain Meadows. And so, with that kind of lead time, you could put something together. Because there weren't a lot of handy warriors in southern Utah. But with that kind of time, you could have whipped something up. And the government sources say there were Indians from the Muddy River. The Muddy River is 90 miles away from Mountain Meadows. That's not a weekend's jaunt. That means you've got to be out there recruiting. So what... If that militia commander... Why is that militia commander giving an order to attack a wagon train he's never seen? Unless he's following orders. As William Dame says, I have my orders. So, and then when it's all... When they're sorting out who we're going to blame for this, as William Dame says to George A. Smith, if you try to put the saddle on me, I'll put the saddle on the right horse. And the crime is fascinating. And the church is getting closer to the truth, maybe, but they're still a long way from being forthright about how ambiguous the evidence is.
Don't you think that the closer they get to the truth or admitting to the truth, the more damning it is?
It's damning in any way, shape, or form. It's not. History isn't black and white, and it isn't an indictment. It's troubling, and this is a very, very morally troubling story.
Sure.
And of the three guys who were listed as authors. The only one who I really thought was morally troubled by it, was Glenn Leonard. Glenn visibly aged, and he was the least active of the three writers. But when they announced, they did a stunt. They announced the big plan for the book, and they'd actually been doing it in secret since at least October. And they'd been sending out archivists to get stuff and misdirect people, tell them stories so that they wouldn't give up the fact that they were researching Mountain Meadows.
Really?
I'd been hearing all these weird rumors, and I knew they were doing something. But when I went into that plenary session in the 2002 MHA meeting, it's the same day I got the advance copies of Blood of the Prophets. Those. They stand up and they do this stunt. The theme was plans for church publishing, and they spring this Mountain Meadows project and say, oh, we've been working on it for about 6 months, and Ron Walker says, well, we think we spent as much as $30,000. Well, we spent that on you, Ron. What do you think the whole project's cost? So it was a stunt, and they laid out exactly the conclusions in their book, and they did. They went through and searched high and low and hither and yon, and overturned every archive, and really didn't turn up much more than what I did.
What about the cover-up afterwards?
Yeah, what about that?
They're supposedly having a second volume that Rick Curley's doing?
Uh-huh. Well, that's what's wrong with the book. All these Mormon reviewers proclaim the church's book, the definitive version. Well, guess what? You can't write the definitive life of the definitive history of the Nixon administration and stop it the day of the burglary. It doesn't. History doesn't work that way. And they came up a day late and a dollar short with their definitive history. And everybody's bailed now except the lead attorney. And Rick and I are friends. And we have these deep professional disagreements. And we certainly don't see eye to eye on this. And I said to him, okay, after they do their big announcement, I ran into Rick in the hall of the hotel. And there was nobody else there. And he came up to me and goes, you know what? I want to thank you, because without your book, none of this would have been possible. And I said, well, thanks. Even though he just answered a question, is your book going to be a response to Bagley's?
Exactly.
Well, both those things can be true, because they were able to use the looming threat of Blood of the Prophets as a wedge to get the church to commit unlimited funds, apparently, because in the 2 years I worked for Frank Singer researching Mountain Meadows, they estimated, when we got into discussions about it later, that they had spent $250,000. They'd been paying me $42,000 a year in salary, health benefits, some other expenses, and then research. A couple of weeks in Washington, the Huntington Library, the Beinecke Library. So they laid out $250,000 for one lowly paid historian for 2 years. So if you had me costing that much, what would, let's see, a dozen people for 5 years, that's 70 people years.
A lot more.
Well, you're into not merely $1 million, as people like to. More than $1 million. Yeah, there's no doubt about that. When I start adding those numbers up, it's more like $10 million, and that's just your baseline. It's still going north. When I was at, 1 year ago, when I was at the National Archives in Washington D.C., which the week we spent there to celebrate my brother's stuff cost us, $1,500 in hotel bills, easily. And we got a real deal. And we were staying out in Rock Creek or someplace. But I'm standing there at the desk where they bring you stuff, or file requests, and Rick Turley's executive assistant comes up to me, and she says, "You come all the way out here just to see me?" And they had heard another poor young lady out there for several weeks going through, I guess, the federal judiciary record, which I'd been through in some detail. But God knows how much they've spent, and they won't say.
No.
But it is not a big secret. People are saying, oh, yeah, they're going to admit the cover-up. Well, when you ask Charlie that, he goes, oh, yeah, there was a cover-up. Well, it's a different cover-up than the one I described. According to them, it's the evil southern Utahns conspiring to keep it all from the benign prophet. And that's Tom Alexander's laid out, essentially, what I believe Rick Turley will present, and that the Lee trial was all a straight-up, fair execution of justice, and that it was a bunch of local leaders. Well, when they did this little stunt, they finally stopped and asked for questions. When I stood up, and I had the privilege of asking the first question, and having heard what they had discovered, which turns out to be exactly what's in their book, I said, have you three thought through the moral implications of once again blaming this on the people of southern Utah? And they just stood there as if they didn't get the question. And they didn't see any moral dimension to it, or didn't see what would be wrong with. Well, if that's what the history is, right. Of course. And I think Juanita Brooks felt that moral ambiguity, that there was a lot of guilt to go around here. And if you shoved it all off on these poor people who had been sent to the ragged edge of the Mormon frontier, as she called it, and give them all the moral culpability in it, you're dishonest. You can't look at all the hate speech coming out of Salt Lake. You can't factor in all that burnt-up evidence. You can't read these, well, you know, the whole Haslam's heroic ride story. Come on, give me a break. Where else in the United States of America, in any part of the West, is there a wagon train under attack 35 miles from town? And what do the citizens do? They gather together and go, let's send a messenger up to the governor who's 250 miles away and see what he tells us to do, eh? That sounds like a good idea. Okay, so the messenger goes up, comes back, but they killed them all. Who killed them all? The Indians? No, the settlers. What's going on here? Well, who knows? Who knows? But you can't say it's all those guys down there. And you can't read those orders that go down to southern Utah and not think, well, what were the original orders? Because these sounds like it's revoking whatever those original orders are, which we don't have. Anyway, but this may sound strange to people who believe that the purpose of history is to support the revealed truth, but I think there's a moral dimension to history, and I hope that my work has that integrity and that moral dimension, and that there's a human sympathy for it, that I try to show the complexities and the choices and the fanaticism and the stark choice that many of these people faced between doing something that they know is evil, but they have to do it because they believe it's religiously the right. It's their orders. It's their religious compulsion. They're killing this person to save them. And you know, if you're going to write propaganda, there's no moral dimension to that. They pay you the money and you do your job, but nobody's paying me.
Did you ever find yourself, angry at the church?
Everybody's been angry at the church. Do you think anybody who's ever lived hasn't cursed some dumb church official or some stupid thing that some general authority said at the wrong time, or just gotten aggravated with the self-righteousness of the exalted?
No, but angry that of such a despicable act as the massacre, and then, you know, still they're obviously trying to open up more little baby steps. But I mean, when you were in the thick of things, right in the blood of the prophets, I mean, did you ever? Because for me, when I was reading the book, I mean, it was very deeply emotional for me to get connected. And I've told this to my wife and to my friends and my parents. I personally don't understand why the massacre has deeply touched my heart. Maybe it's just because I feel terrible for those people. And, you know, I've wept many days over those people. But then once that settles down, it turns into anger, at least for me and for some people. I don't know.
Well, you know, the only thing that really has made me mad is being denied access to sources.
Sure.
And the privileging that they're going to show these people because we can trust them to say what we want. but you get over that because there's so much stuff out there. And the truth is mighty and will prevail. You're going to find it. Now, to deal with and that sense of anger over what happened, it was so morally outrageous. And it, to me, what I find troubling and offensive is that if you look at it from a legal term, Brigham Young got away with murder. Because as I think I explained to you, that Juanita Brooks, to my mind, settled who was morally responsible when she said that Brigham Young and George A. Smith set up, created the social conditions that made them this.
Yeah.
And if that's not moral responsibility, I don't know what it is.
Right.
I think it went much further. I think that they schemed to put together a political incident. Brigham Young had to demonstrate his power to shut down the Overland Road, and he targeted, he said he wanted an Indian incident down there. Or maybe he said, I don't want a single American leaving southern Utah. Kill everybody above the age of innocence. And there's some evidence that that's what the order was. Now, there was some order that went down there, because you can read the countermanding orders. What exactly George A. Smith ordered, neither Isaac Haight nor William Dame would ever testify or even say, but they would also never exonerate Brigham Young, because that's all they had between them and the noose. And they knew it. And Brigham Young knew it. And when William Dame told George A. Smith, if you try to saddle me with this, I'll put the saddle on the right horse, George A. Smith knew exactly who the right horse was. And when powerful politicians target innocent civilians for violent action, for a political end, what is that? We have a word for it now. And the first time I've ever seen any form of that word is in the pardon that President James Buchanan issued to Brigham Young and the traitors in Utah. And it said, they have created a system, a strange system of terrorism, where people dare not trust the government. A strange system of terrorism. Well, when you target innocent civilians, and that's what I think that's the thesis of Blood of the Prophets that nobody debates, nobody recognizes. You've got all these critiques of Blood of the Prophets that demolish straw men. If you go through, the Buick Farms published a lawyer's attack on my history of the Lee trial. And if you're an attorney, I've had attorneys tell me that, yeah, that's a real piece of work. But if you go through and you ask this question, every one of those arguments is a straw man. Because he says, Blood of the Prophet says this. No, it doesn't. Blood of the Prophet says this. No, it doesn't. It says this. If you go through and look at all the things he says, Blood of the Prophet says, go try to find him. Show me where I say that. I don't. I present the ambiguity of the evidence, but that the weight of the total evidence is the fix was in. And everybody knew it. And Mormons knew it. And the jurors knew it. And John D. Lee, he finally figured it out. But we'll get another set of denials about, oh no, the conspiracy was that they kept Brigham Young in the dark all the way till 1870, and then he excommunicated him, and then he let him back in, and then he protected him, but... See, finally he turned over John D. Lee. And you know, in a lot of ways, you got to. If Brigham Young would have just said to John D. Lee, "John, you're my adopted son. Somebody's got to take the fall for this, and you're the man. And if you will do this, you've already got your second anointing, and you've been sealed to Godhood. And I'll see you when I get up there, and everything will be Jake." Lee would have gone to his grave swearing, defending the great prophet. And this stuff about how Lee never implicates Brigham Young Well, they'd been smart enough not to give the orders to Lee, except for the ambiguous orders that George A. Smith passes on. Gee, if you attacked him here, you could really give him a hard time, huh? And let me tell you what, it wasn't Lee's attorney who wrote that. That was written by John D. Lee, and it's in early versions, and it's in all those versions. It's in the version that Lee's prosecutor published. And he didn't make it up. And George A. Smith, even the church's book, finally says, well, George A. Smith probably said some pretty dumb things down there. Yeah, really. Well, what he did was he set up a massacre, because that's what happened. And you can't just say, well, we didn't anticipate that happening. No, they probably, maybe they didn't. Maybe they hadn't thought through what happens when you start the rock rolling. And next thing you know, you got an avalanche. But if you started that rock rolling, whose fault is the avalanche?
Good point.
Anyway, I get all worked up about this. Yeah. But, you know, I feel frustrated that there's so much time and energy spent on defending what I think is indefensible. And, you know, you just got to play it as it lies. And I do feel, you know, it is really aggravating to have all these people question your moral integrity, misrepresent what you said, use any means possible. And it goes back to what I see as one of the great moral contradictions of Mormonism and its history. And I end Blood of the Prophets by saying the trouble with what Brigham Young and his leaders were doing was that they believed the ends justified the means. And I think that still is the great moral ambiguity. I saw a Mormon historian explain how you could give this totally false lesson on the handcarts from the materials without ever touching the basic injustice and inhumanity of the event. But by doing the job of building the faith, and therefore the truth, to hell with it, as long as the end justifies the means. And if the means is the glory of the kingdom, then that's Jake. It doesn't matter if you have to lie or kill or cheat or swindle or murder or just pass off a few fables as the truth. As long as it builds up the kingdom, that's sweet. And I don't buy that. But again, I get all excited about this stuff, but I've had such an amazing experience, and I've been so lucky to have worked with Brigham Matson, the grand old man of Mormon history, Floyd A. O'Neill, who taught generations of Utahns the truth about their history. Greg Thompson, who has taken what Ev Cooley started and built one of the great collections of Western Americana. My friend and mentor and my only living father, David L. Bigler, who is also a man of immense decency, and one of those handful of Christians I've been privileged to know, and a gifted historian, and one of the most creative historians who can look at a piece of evidence and say, no, that doesn't make any sense at all. But if you follow it through like this, the reason the Utah War turns on a dime is because of the collapse of the Lemhi Indian Mission. And that's a great story. And what does he use to tell it? He uses the story of the poor guys who were sent up there to marry the Lamanites and get ready for the second coming and push the kingdom well into Oregon territory. And it turns out that poor Lewis Shirtliff has a girlfriend in Ogden, and he doesn't want to marry old Snag's daughter. And, you know, these are the stories of Mormonism that have kept me going. And I've got about 3 or 4 more volumes to wrap up. And then I hope by 2012, have finished editing all the Kingdom of the West volumes, and it'll be 15 or 16. And they're going to be a Hawaiian history of the Hawaiian mission by Francis Asbury Cannon, or Hammond, who's one of the great forgotten frontiersmen of the Mormon West. A great volume on Mormon dissidents that I'm doing with Polly Aird and Jeff Nichols, who are two of the best and brightest historians I've ever met, and a lot of fun, too. A book that Dale Morgan called the best 49er journal he'd ever seen, William Lorton, who's quite thinks about joining the Mormons, even.
Really?
And tells Addison Pratt that he is pretty much converted.
Oh, wow.
From the experiences on the desert. And then finally, this epic documentary history of Mormon Indians and Mormons, and which will present every Indian perspective from firsthand or close to firsthand Indian viewpoints we can find, and items like Dimmick Huntington's journal, which is just a staggering, hands-on, take you back to 1857. Interpretation of what Mormons believed, and Jacob Hamblin's narrative, which is one of the really stunning pieces of frontier literature. And look at all these characters.
I can't tell you enough. I really appreciated you taking the time and giving us the food for thought. I personally, this means a lot to me. You know, you have played a pretty big role in my life, at least in the last 5 years.
Well, you see, we're in my office now, and we're in my outer office.
Right.
You've seen the inner sanctum.
Mm-hmm.
You know what? Writing is a pretty lonely job. And writing books, you know, here's my 3-pound book. It's huge. It's the biggest book I've ever written. But, you know, I think it's entirely possible in the 1950s this would have been a bestseller.
Yeah.
This would have put me up there with Bernard DeBoto and Wallace Stegner, those guys who could get on the bestseller list for the history. Those days are gone. And it may be that all the people who care about the Oregon-California trails have died 20 years ago. And besides that, nobody's going to put that on a computer. Nobody's going to put that on a Kindle. So it's like I'm working on a dead art, but it's all I know how to do. But it's such an isolated undertaking, and it's so encouraging to have people like you say, it touched my life.
It really has, and you know, as lonely as it is sometimes, it's just as lonely for me reading your work and the stuff you put together and trying to contextualize and compartmentalize all of my emotions and feelings and beliefs, trying to figure out where I'm going to go from here. It's invaluable, you know, what you've done and what you'll continue to do. So I just want to...
And you know... one thing I think when we were emailing back and forth, I mentioned that I've never felt that I was going to expose Mormonism to somebody.
Right.
I mean, or bring people into the light of unbelief.
Deconvert them.
Yeah, because I've never really felt that Mormon history has much to do with believing in religion. Now, that may sound strange, but I remember 20 years ago when all these documents were being hidden. You know, the church recently published that Joseph Smith draft Revelations book.
Right.
The closest we've gotten back to the manuscripts. And that was locked up in Joseph Fielding Smith's safe when I was had just come back to Utah, or he just died. But there's a reason that stuff was hidden. And the reason it was hidden was that they believed that if people saw this stuff, they'd leave it en masse. Everybody just pack it up and leave. Well, that didn't happen. And it didn't happen because people don't believe in Mormonism because of the credible history. People believe in Mormonism for a lot of other different reasons. And my sense is people deserve an honest telling of their history. And certainly the Mormon people do. And it's not going to be all inspiring, but it ultimately, it's a testament to human experience, to the human endurance. It's often a testament of the heroism of many, many, many people. And the basic decent goodness of this culture that both of us have grown up in, and which, if you've been raised in it, you owe a lot to. But it also is a record of contemptible exploitation and vicious behavior, and examples of old truths like power corrupts. But in the midst of even the worst of these abuses and stories, you find those simple acts of heroism and courage that give people hope. Yeah. And we can all find that in a wealth of examples of that in the Mormon past. And I think to see that the church has now published that volume and that they've opened up so much, and that Mormon Pioneer Overland Company website, you can go back and touch your ancestors. I found out that my great-great-grandmother, Julia Grant Bagley, who was my great-grandfather's mother, died when he was 1 year old at Deer Creek in 20 miles west of the Missouri River of cholera. Miserable, miserable death. And I found out that when the church's freight train with the steam engine came through the next fall, they saw the bones scattered all over. Yeah. The wolves had dug her up. But that kind of sacrifice and heroism and brutal human experience, it's just profoundly disturbing, but it tells me a lot about who I am. And our past can tell all of us a lot about who we are.
I agree.
And I hope I haven't made your journey harder anyway.
Oh, it's... thank you again, Will.
And that will end part two of our two-part discussion with Will Bagley. Again, I want to thank him for letting us have some of his music from his album, The Legend of Jesse James, that we could use on these two podcasts. And I also want to, once again, highly recommend his Kingdom in the West series. It was done by Arthur H. Clarke Company. I can't recommend this series highly enough. Like we said, it was going to be 15, 16 volumes. Some of the books are called The Pioneer Camp of the Saints, Forgotten Kingdom, Scoundrel's Tale, Army of Israel, Defending Zion, Fort Limhi, and of course, Innocent Blood, Volume 12. So I encourage you to go to MormonExpression.com. We'll have the links up there where you can find more information on the series and maybe how to get your hands on some of those books. And also, Will wanted me to mention some of the scholars that he worked with on that series. Dave Bigler, Ken Owens, Mike Homer, Carmen Hardy, just to name a few. There was quite a few people that worked with him on that series. So I also want to give a big thanks to Will for spending the time sharing his stories with us. I encourage you to go to MormonExpression.com because the discussion will continue there. Give us your comments at mail@MormonExpression.com or leave comments on the website. And you can also call us in at 801-906-6722. Thanks again.
Just my husband Robert and I, no one else around. just can't take no more. Tomorrow I gotta go. I've had enough of farming, laying down my plow. I never was so awful good, never liked it anyhow. It's like the old man dreaming, talking in the dark. Son, it's too much pain to pay. Farming will break your heart. Say goodbye to Frank and Jess. Goodbye to both my sons. Say goodbye to Ma and Pa. Just tell them that I'm gone. Well, I believe I'll go to the western lands, preaching the land of gold, saving the miners from their sins where the winters are deep and cold. And sure enough, my darling, I'll send for you down the line.
Then I had to turn away, didn't want him to see me cry.
So say goodbye to Frank and Jess. Goodbye to both my sons. Say goodbye to Ma and Pa. Just tell them that I'm gone.